Good afternoon, everyone. On behalf of USIP, the Jennings Randolph Fellowship Program in particular, I'd like to welcome you all here today for the very first in our 2000 series of project reports. My name is Lynn Tesser. I'm a program officer in the Fellowship Program, and I'll also be serving as the moderator. Now, each spring and summer, we ask our current senior fellows to give public presentations on their research in progress, or in other words, to give a project report like the one we have today. And we do this for at least two reasons. First of all, to give everyone a glimpse of the research, and secondly, to give our fellows the opportunity to receive feedback, I think, at a really critical time on their work. So we're really looking forward to the comments and questions that you have today. And of course, we're beginning our project report series by featuring a real star in the field of transitional justice. It's my great pleasure to formally introduce Senior Fellow Michael Johnson, who will be talking to us today about complementarity between the International Criminal Court and national justice systems. Michael has served as the Registrar for the War Crimes Chamber of the Court of Bosnia and Herzegovina since 2004. From 2001 to 2004, he was the Chief of Prosecutions for the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, the ICTY. And prior to that, he worked for many years as the County Attorney in Concord, New Hampshire. This year, in fact, the New Hampshire Bar Association named him the Daniel Webster International Lawyer of the Year. So we're absolutely delighted to have someone with such achievements and experience here to enlighten us about complementarity. Now, I'll just mention we can look forward to two more upcoming project reports by senior fellows Betty Bagombe and Joyce New, who are also working on transitional justice issues. Betty, on June 15th, will be giving a presentation entitled Turning War into Peace, An Insider's View from Northern Uganda. Joyce, on July 5th, Joyce New will be talking about pursuing justice in the midst of war, Bosnia and the ICTY. In addition to these project reports, USIP has done a good deal of work on transitional justice. Of course, we have our three-volume set on transitional justice. We also have a number of special reports, some of which are on the table out front and also can be downloaded from our website. And finally, I'll mention the recent launching of INPRAL, which stands for the International Network to Promote the Rule of Law, which is basically an internet-based network to link up practitioners to try and share best practices and other information. Okay. Now, for the media in the room, I'd just like to offer our usual disclaimer, which is to remind you that Michael's views do not necessarily reflect the views of USIP, as USIP does not reflect, or rather advocate specific policies. This event will be recorded and will be put on our website in about a week, so you can listen to it once, twice, as many times as you like. At this point in time, I'd like to give special thanks to Michael's research assistant, Meredith McCormack, over here, who's just actually tomorrow finishing up her MA at the School of International Service at American University. So we'd like to congratulate her for that. And finally, I'd like to ask everyone to please turn off your cell phones and BlackBerrys so that we don't have any interference in the microphone system. So please do that now. As far as our format today, Michael will talk for about a half an hour. Then we'll open up the floor for questions and comments. Okay? So with that, I'll turn over the floor to Michael.
Great. Thank you, Lynn, very much.
Sure.
As Lynn indicated, this is a seasonal thing that USIP encourages us senior fellows to do. And it is an opportunity at a fairly early stage of the development of a book on this topic for us, and especially in this instance, me, to get your feedback. The topic that we're addressing in formal terms is complementarity, and reconsidering the definition as it's been applied by the ICC over the course of the last several years. Complementarity, as you all know, is the concept that sovereignty and international justice have to somehow marry their authority. And international justice, as evidenced by the International Criminal Court, a permanent institution, has authority over a sovereign state in certain circumstances. Again, only those sovereign states that allow the ICC to have that authority by ratifying the Rome Statute. So it's an interesting first development or major development in the construction of an international justice system. Imagine, if you would, that the ICC is a federal court and each sovereign state is a state within our union, and we're trying to negotiate back in the 1830s. What is the relationship between the state courts and the state legal structures governed by state parliamentary or legislative bodies and executive branch and the rest? What is their relationship? What is the balance between their power and their authority and that of the common whole? We have come at this stage in the last 15 years in defining what the rule of law means, as most of you know, to an understanding that it certainly does not mean absolute autonomy for a sovereign state. In fact, it means that there are certain common values that have been generated over the course of the last century or so that every country, every state, every nation, every cultural body should recognize and honor. And we refer to those in many respects as human rights, or human dignity, and the Genocide Convention is an example of that. We also begin to realize in the 1980s that there is little or no enforcement mechanism for those common values. So it would be like a provision of our state law that says that sexual assault or rape is illegal, but we have no police and we have no courts to enforce it. So when it occurs, we stand back and we shake our head and say, we don't agree with that, but there's nothing that we can do. And that's the circumstance we found ourselves in Bosnia, as the former Yugoslavia fell apart, and the widespread and systematic abuses that occurred there began to appear on the national televisions of countries all over the world, especially the Western powers that have been in the leadership of this ideal of human rights and human dignity and universal human rights. With that, I would like to back up just a little bit and sort of structure how I'd like to spend the next 15-20 minutes. First of all, I'm a career prosecutor and I'm not an academic, so the paper that you have is an interesting exercise. I would hope that each of you will go home and with charity look at it and send me an email, again with charity, and suggest your best judgment as to how it can be improved. It is, in my opinion, redundant. It is repetitive because it is indeed, we've been having this discussion, it is the sort of cut and paste of a number of different chapters in this book that I'm writing, which it will, I hope, explain both my expectation of the future of international justice and the model that has been developed in Bosnia-Herzegovina with the International Criminal Court for the former Yugoslavia, the ICTY, the UN Tribunal, that has been in existence for about 13 years now, and the justice sector in Bosnia-Herzegovina, in both Republic Srpska and in the Federation, and ultimately on the national level, the state level, in the court of Bosnia-Herzegovina, war crimes chamber and organized crime, economic crime, and corruption chamber. It is my effort or my intention, and those of you who are academics and write a great deal, you appreciate the difference between the ideal and the delivery. I hope my delivery is something close to my ideal, but I would like to be able to express in clear terms the history of our international involvement in restoring the rule of law in Bosnia as a national process of national institutions governed within the democratic environment of a state, and the international justice response on the UN level of producing an international tribunal with supranational authority and the mandate of the international community to bring international law, IHL, into a sovereign state. Now, there are a lot of interesting discussions that we can have in respect to the use of those terms and applying to any of those institutions, whether or not Bosnia was a sovereign state, whether or not it is today, whether the international involvement has been good or bad, a productive or destructive of their evolution or reconstruction of their society is debatable. But I think the role of the rule of law nationally and internationally is a very good study for us, not just to point fingers or to come up with explanations for why Bosnia is not better off or is worse off or is as good off as it happens to be at the moment, but rather because it is the best model that we have at the moment for how complementarity can actually work for the ICC. And if the future is the ICC and the past is the ad hoc effort seen in Rwanda and even Sierra Leone and the former Yugoslavia, ICTY, then we can look towards the ICC and say, what is it that we as academics and practitioners and diplomats and the like, what can we do to make the ICC work better? The term reconciliation is kind of a litmus test that is available to us in that examination. And if you can throw the first slide up, I think I would like to discuss. We need a password. Yeah. We'll turn the lights off. Anyone who would like to sleep, please do so. You are welcome. And if enough of you actually do sleep, I'll slip out and come back and wake you up when the time is finished. What I've done is essentially assembled a number of photographs, because what I would like to do is conceptualize what I've been trying to do, and that is challenge sovereignty in a certain way and expand the concept of our obligation to engage to deliver justice in post-conflict environments. This is a beautiful memorial in the Jewish cemetery in Sarajevo. Any of you who've ever been there, I think you will recognize, those of you who have not will appreciate it. It is a stack of white stone with a beautiful black Bosnian black marble. That's their sort of signature marble. And it has the names, has inscriptions all the way around on all four sides. This particular side, which was away from both the mountain and also the valley in which Sarajevo exists, and therefore out of the range of fire of any of the combatants. And it is pristine. In this panel list, as you can notice, the death camps and the concentration camps that obliterated the Jewish community of the former Yugoslavia during the Second World War. A beautiful memorial, obviously the result of the process of reconciliation in Bosnia between the ethnic groups that were various aligned with the various parties in that huge conflict. Next, if you could. The topic, as I indicated, is defining complementary or expanding the definition of complementary. If we can go on. This is that memorial from the hillside, looking down from where the Serb gunners were placed. And this particular panel, as you notice, is damaged. Can you go on? At the beginning of the international justice response to Bosnia in 1995, Judge or President Kesesi, who is a great author and very vital force in building international justice even today, said the following: justice is an indispensable ingredient of the process of national reconciliation. Two words, very critical words, depending on how we define them.
It is essential to the restoration of peaceful and normal relations between people who have had to live under a reign of terror. It breaks the cycle of violence, hatred, and extrajudicial retribution. Thus, peace and justice go hand in hand. He was the president of the tribunal at that point in November of 1995, about 5 months after Srebrenica had occurred, with General Mladic saying publicly and proudly to the world, "I am the world's greatest war criminal according to this man in this court." So you don't have anything to fear from your God, you have to have something to fear from me, as he loaded 8,000 men and boys on transports to their death. In an area where the same authority, the international community, us, were protecting them. So the UN tribunal was saying this 6 months after the UN itself had handed over its arms to those who were doing something very different. Then Kofi Annan, the head of DPKO in Rwanda, as you all recall, in 1994, and then the Secretary General replacing Boutros-Ghali said in 1997, "Impunity cannot be tolerated and will not be. In an interdependent world, the rule of law must prevail." Again, critical terms of art. What do they mean? What does impunity mean? And how do we differentiate between this expression, "impunity cannot be tolerated," and "never again," something that was memorialized on that stone with the death camp, names of the death camp? He was visiting the tribunal and, of course, inspiring those who were struggling at that time to figure out a way of imposing or enforcing the rule of law that was representing the consensus of the community of nations in another sovereign state. In fact, several of them. Serbia, Montenegro, and at the time, Kosovo, as part of the former Yugoslavia, Bosnia-Herzegovina, which was occupied by the international community and large military and political force with a high representative, Croatia that had recently gained independence, and Slovenia that had recently gained independence as well. What does reconciliation mean when a symbol of that reconciliation 40 years actually, after the conflagration of the Second World War, and a tribute to the crimes of the fascists in Bosnia-Herzegovina, 1941-1945, becomes the target of a Serb gunner sitting up in the hills, attempting to give a statement. There's nothing other than editorial comment that this shot would have, in fact, produced. There's nothing that the round that was fired at this could have done other than deface the memorial. Why? What is reconciliation, and how do we achieve it? Nuremberg was a process of bringing reconciliation and justice. And lastly, I think it's critical that we understand the ultimate posture of the practitioners. Carlo Del Ponte was my boss at both the ICTY in The Hague and when I was harassing dead people in Rwanda for a period of time in 2002. She is still the chief prosecutor of the ICTY and was the lead counsel of record on the Milosevic case, the first case of bringing an individual of his stature to justice. All Africa News reported that on October 11, 2006, 9 years after Kofi Annan stated his statement, the prosecutors of the international tribunals gathered for the third time in The Hague, Netherlands. They have an annual collegium for a roundtable conference dedicated to the impact of justice on national reconciliation. Again, terms of art, what do they mean? Carlo Del Ponte, speaking as the prosecutor for the ICTY, was quoted as saying, I have seen no sign of national reconciliation, but this is not our task.
even if we hope to contribute. A very discouraging statement of fact from the world's most powerful prosecutor in respect to the crimes committed in the former Yugoslavia. This is Bosnia a year and a half ago. This is now being beginning to be rebuilt by the Greeks. Thank you very much. It is the Parliament building in downtown Sarajevo, for those of you who've ever been there. The great symbol of our international commitment to the rule of law and the dignity of man and human rights during the period of the siege of Sarajevo that went on for several years was this building, the Parliament of a free state, declared independent and recognized as such, burning on fire, smoking. That and the press building of the major news outlet were the two major symbols of Bosnia. Those of you who spent a lot of time there know and recognize them. You'll notice that the two buildings that have been, in fact, are new and rebuilt are the Office of the High Representative, which is the presence of the international community in Bosnia, and the Holiday Inn. The Holiday Inn, of course, is quite spectacular. This is an area, this is the entire Parliament building that is still destroyed, and of course the bank building. So international banking, international governance, and international commerce are alive and well in Bosnia. The unemployment rate is about 40%, I think, and that's official, or sort of official. Okay, go on, if you could. This is another example of the neighborhoods of Sarajevo. Reconciliation, what does it mean? In a rapid polarization of population in Bosnia, Sarajevo was becoming very much of a homogenous city. They are indeed paving the streets, but they're not rebuilding the buildings as quickly as possible. But those that they are doing very quickly and very nicely, because they're rented out at 5 or 10 times the going rate to foreign international participants in the reconstruction and reconciliation process. Another good example, as I said, of that interesting reconstruction. Go ahead. Keep going. This is Nuremberg. All of you heard of it, thought of it. What was the impact of Nuremberg? What was the impact of the concept of Nuremberg? What is the relevance of Nuremberg as a victor's justice process at the end of a major war where the foreign powers that included the Soviet Union, the United States, France, Great Britain, were in a position to impose their law on those who suffered the consequences of the loss of that war. And Nick. Yeah, it's slow. Yeah. We love apples at USIP, but they are very laid back and slow. They force you to be copacetic with your work. This is a road, again, as we define reconciliation. If you go down the street to the Holocaust Museum, you will find in their photographic gallery a whole series of photographs of the individuals who were taken from Pavlovsk prison in Warsaw on trucks in 1940, 41, 42, and driven down this road every morning. Next. And put into these trenches as a consequence of the execution of their sentence, their death sentence, because they were some Catholics, and if you saw the entire, it's about the size of a football field, and it's one of a number of them, Palmyria's the place, a killing field. And there are students and priests, baggage carriers and teachers, lawyers and doctors, and they each have their names and their date of death on them, because they were exhumed after the war and this memorial was established. Nobody goes there anymore. It's out in the middle of nowhere in a forest outside of Warsaw,
and it's hard to keep going.
Palmyra is filled with Jewish gravestones and Catholic gravestones of the Polish people, and that reconciliation process, that justice process, is still being debated today. In fact, it wasn't too terribly long ago that the German president went to Warsaw and apologized for just these crimes. This is the court in Sierra Leone. It is an extraordinary effort on the part of the United Nations to provide justice in place. As you know, the ICTY, a UN institution, is in the Netherlands, not in Bosnia or the former Yugoslavia. Another form of the idea of justice, where will this be in 15 years? Metal container offices and a beautiful courthouse that exceeds in any respect any other investment in a public building in Sierra Leone at the moment. But nonetheless, a very clear statement of the international community that the crimes that were committed here are not just the problem of Sierra Leone. Because the sovereignty of Sierra Leone, who owns it? If Sierra Leone is a sovereign state, who owns that sovereignty? The people, the victims, the public, the leaders, their diplomats, who? And who is entitled to speak for it in that amorphous international community, the IC? Huge investment in the court in Sierra Leone, witness protection, accommodations, thanks, where they can stay. In many respects, much nicer than the homes that they have come from. What are we doing for Sierra Leone? What is reconciliation in Sierra Leone? Is the UN able to do that effectively? Does it have the right skills? What is its role? And how much authority does it have to impose its will or its judgment, reflecting the international community, on the people of Sierra Leone? These are those people. They're very charming and very bright and very real. And they're not us. This is Bosnia. This is the court of Bosnia-Herzegovina. It's the Viktor Buban Barracks in Sarajevo. You'll see other pictures of it in a minute. But in this quick review, it is the situs for the state court of Bosnia-Herzegovina. We got new windows in it to start with. Thanks to the EU grants. This project was about $47 million injected into the justice sector of Bosnia-Herzegovina beginning in 2003 with a donors conference and a commitment for a memorandum of understanding. In 2007, today, it has, 15,000 square meters of office space and courtroom space that is of the same quality, if not better, than what exists in The Hague. I'm about to do something that some of you may wonder, and I'll explain it if you like, but I'm going to compare the costs and the product of our investment in the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia and our investment in the War Crimes Chamber, Organized Crime and Corruption Chamber, and State Court of Bosnia-Herzegovina. And I think that's where we need to begin our examination of where our investment is best placed. And let me answer it very quickly from my view. It's never an either-or. It's always a both. There must be both. The question is, what is the appropriate allocation of resources? $140 million, Neil, you have probably a better, more recent view, $1 million will be spent in 2007 for the operations of the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia in The Hague. $140 million in 1 year. The entire cost of constructing, and by the way, we're renting the building. When we're done, we'll give it back. We built and rebuilt and are in the process of rebuilding again the courtrooms in that building. This construction on a site in the middle of Sarajevo, with the total investment, including the international component, which is the most expensive, paying us to be there to help them, is $47 million, plus another $8 million of their own money. That's for 5 years, and will produce and leave behind an infrastructure that is worth probably a quarter of that, that will always be available to them. Six courtrooms, as opposed to the three in The Hague, they have six times the capacity to produce or process trials. They have an obligation under the law, the national law of Bosnia-Herzegovina, to complete a case within a year. If not, the accused is released. They have engaged in the world's largest genocide trial in terms of numbers of defendants, and in my humble opinion, one of the most sophisticated courtrooms in the world today, built in this courthouse. And you'll see pictures of that construction in a minute. That courthouse is run with twice the capacity of the ICTY that has three courtrooms, with a greater turnover in cases than does the ICTY, with exactly the same international standards being met. How do we know that? Because the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, representing the international community, said so in the case of Radovan Stanković, when they transferred that accused, an indictee in the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, back to the state court of Bosnia-Herzegovina in September of 2005. The first such transfer ever in the history of international justice. They have, or will shortly, complete their transfer of cases with the delivery, hopefully, of Milan Lukic, a major butcher in the Vlasenica, Visegrad, Zvornik area of eastern Bosnia during the war. He was extradited from Argentina back to the international court under international law, and then sent back to the state court. Argentina is now objecting, saying, wait a minute, we'd known he was going back to Bosnia, we'd have never extradited him, or rendited him, whatever the proper term is. And the international court is saying, that's too bad. You don't have the authority to control that. Perhaps it's under litigation in the appeals chamber as we speak today. The USAID, I took this photograph because USAID has a wonderful way of putting its picture on everything. And I wanted you to see that picture on the blown up building as we were in the process. That was for the contribution prior to this one. AID committed no funds to this court during our the development of the War Crimes Chamber there. Okay, go on. This is the library in Sarajevo. Many of you saw that as the other icon of culture burning. What was it, 14,000 or 14 million volumes, some awful figure of the most incredible collection of great culture of the region. Sarajevo being a crossroads, Bosnia being a crossroads between great empires and great cultures and great history. It was burned by incendiary fire into the library. They are reconstructing it now, again, 12 years after it was burned. Reconciliation, reconstruction, what does this mean? This is a beautiful building that they're doing a very fine job reconstructing, but where are the books? Where are the manuscripts? Where is the culture that was in this building? And how will they restore that? How long, in other words, does it take before reconciliation has occurred? And I think that's a critical question for us to ask when we say that is our obligation. Because peace and justice are durable things. They're not things that happen quickly. And our attention span as practitioners and as diplomats and as ordinary citizens of countries that support these circumstances has to reflect it. Luis Ocampo, the ICC prosecutor,
a great hero, I think, in many respects. Flawed human being like we all are, struggling to build an institution that was never built before. And he's doing a pretty fine job of it, and making, again, all the mistakes that you would expect he would make. But he keeps telling me, Michael, we're not making any of the ones that you made at the tribunals. I said, well, that's good. Then we'll make our own mistake. He says, as a consequence of complementarity, the relationship that he has with state parties and the sovereign state, whoever represents that authority, as a consequence of complementarity, the number of cases that reach the court should not be a measure of its efficiency. On the contrary, the absence of trials before this court as a consequence of the regular functioning of national institutions would be a major success. I'll end this process with a whole series of my travel photos of most of these institutions with more interesting pictures after we finish the questions. This is Sarajevo at night, and this is the shell that is the public library. Again, 12 years after it was burned. It is a beautiful building that is being reconstructed, but the culture that was in it is gone. How do we define reconciliation? I'll tell you something else. If the Serb gunners thought that they were going to eliminate the Muslims from Sarajevo, the result 12 years later is a mosque on every corner in Sarajevo. Those of you who enjoy the sound of call to prayers, it's a wonderful thing. I was having I was at the University of Utah, Salt Lake, the other day, and we were piping into our presentation the chief prosecutor, the head prosecutor, and at the time it was about 5 o'clock something in the afternoon, and he said, I'm sorry, and he started to give his presentation over the speakerphone, he said, I'm sorry, but I'll be interrupted in a moment by a very melodic and beautiful sound. That's the call to prayer. You'll have to excuse me. And he did, in fact, after a moment, have it broken into with that noise, and it is a lovely one. But that is Sarajevo today. How do you reconcile a people? The international community is made up also of Islamic states who are very much involved in reconstruction in the area and building mosques and cultural centers everywhere. That is in Europe. And it is a reality that all of us have to appreciate, that multicultural is a very difficult thing to artificially reconstruct. All right, that's it. Somebody turn the lights on.
I'll get it.
Yeah. The last thing I'd like to say is that all of my meandering through the process of, as a practitioner, of trying to figure out from the constituent's viewpoint what this justice thing is all about. It comes down to a very simple diagram. And Jenny and John and Lynn kept saying, you have to make this lively. I said, okay, I'll do graphics. And this is my graphic. You're welcome. I'm going to try to copyright it, so don't anybody... You're welcome to write it down, though, and use it at will. It is called the triangle. And it reflects in my mind the simplest way I can describe what is necessary when you are delivering justice in crimes of this magnitude. Crimes of this magnitude in Nuremberg were prosecuted collectively. The SS, the corrupt government agencies that committed crimes, the National Socialist Party. And membership was a taint as a consequence, regardless of whether you were a bureaucrat or a shooter on a mass grave, whether you were in the Reich Main Security Office in Berlin signing requisitions for bullets, or you were actually on the line in Riga shooting poor innocents as an Einsatzgruppe rifle. The reality is that our justice has changed from that. And the two ad hoc tribunals and now the ICC see the concept of criminal liability for massive crimes as an individual thing.
you have to have both intent and criminal conduct in order to be held culpable and responsible. That's an interesting challenge. And having been a practitioner there and trying to write indictments for people like Milosevic and Karadzic and the like, it is very difficult to understand how you articulate the relationship between widespread and systematic crimes of violence, mass murder or genocide, and the conduct of an executive who is ultimately and morally responsible for those crimes because of the things they did within their sphere of power and influence. How do you articulate that in a classic criminal model of the actor did certain things with the intent to cause the harm that was prohibited? I suggest that governments are, and sovereignty is exercised through a hierarchy. Regardless of how consensus works in there and the like, regardless of what system it is, there's ultimately a refinement of power from the greater constituency. Also, in organized crime or genocide or war crimes that corrupt an entire society, the same general dynamic exists. And if you are going to commit genocide, you're not going to do it alone. You're going to do it by corrupting those institutions that have the capacity to commit genocide or widespread and systematic abuses. And as such, that process of corrupting makes you liable for the crimes that occur. At least that's our theory at the point in the evolution of IHL. However, when that corruption occurs, the police may be corrupted and commit crimes that are not necessarily prosecutable, but nonetheless very reprehensible when seen in the context of the harm that this can do. What about the truck driver that removed the bodies after the bulldozer operator dumped them into the back of his truck from the mass graves in Srebrenica and moved them to another place after the graves were identified and the crimes in Srebrenica became public? What about them? Are they guilty? What is their responsibility? And what is the responsibility of the logistics officer or the mayor or the construction company executive who facilitated that process by giving those machines and his drivers to do such a massive cover-up? How do we hold them responsible? What is the appropriate justice response? There's a great film called The Scorpion Tape. Most of you probably heard about it. It was revealed during the Milosevic trial by Natasha Kantic. And it is a very obscene and vulgar replication of what we saw during the Holocaust in Eastern Europe. Mass killing. Cruel, vulgar, and obscene by individual shooters who almost toyed with their victims, young Bosnian males. I had two New York Times articles on that that I have read whenever I've shown that tape to someone. One of them was about one of the victims who survived the mass shootings, crawled out from under the bodies and lived and testified in the head. The other was about one of the men in the film who was seen ordering the others to shoot and kill. And their history 10 years after that film was taken, right, contemporaneous with Srebrenica. I now have a third. The other day, there was an article in the New York Times about the conviction of those men in the tape by a Belgrade court for crimes committed in Bosnia. What does that mean? What does that mean to us as a justice response? There have been numerous accused, incarcerated, convicted and incarcerated even for genocide in the tribunal in The Hague for Srebrenica, but in Bosnia there are 12 young men, police officers, who are responsible for genocide in Srebrenica, hopefully, as a prosecutor, They will be when the verdict comes in, I trust. Being tried by the state court in Bosnia for the Kravica warehouse killing of about 1,100. That's the largest genocide trial at the moment in the world. Where on this hierarchy of culpability, from Slobodan Milosevic to that truck driver, do we divide the work? Is the ICC here to simply remove the Charles Taylors,
the Slobodan Milosevic's, the Colonel Bagasoras, or the Jean Kabandas of Rwanda? Is that what they're for?
If it is, then we can afford very expensive justice at $125, $30, about $5 million a year, because these are very difficult cases, and they're very important to the entire world. But so also are all these cases. And where do they go? Lesson we learned from the ad hoc tribunals, the UN tribunals, is they don't go here. Because when they go here, they are very difficult to justify. And their sentences come out looking very strange. I was a prosecutor for 20 years in the national system, on the ABA and the rest. There is no statute of limitations for murder in this country. There shouldn't be one outside this country in the international community. Secondly, sentences for vicious, cold-blooded crimes of violence are harsh ones, regardless of where you are, even in Italy, where life imprisonment is 20 years. Whether we have the death penalty or not, 5 years for crimes like that are obscene. If we are giving those kinds of sentences here, it's because we have the wrong people here. And maybe there are other things, rather than retributive justice models like ours, that can deal with those people differently. Reconciliation is found somewhere here in the rule of law. And the rule of law in all of its attributes. It is also a much better investment long term to put the majority, not all, but the majority of our money here, because it's sustainable for every other use of the rule of law and the maintenance of institutions of peace. That's sort of what I'm trying to get at. My mother said, as yours did, that life isn't fair. For the longest time, we also looked at genocide and said that's not fair either. It is our obligation to make life fair, somehow, over the course of the rest of our lives and the lives of our children. It is the rule of law that will be the vehicle to achieve that. And that is a very complex process. So I invite your condemnation or criticism or anything but rejection.
Thank you very much. Okay. Do I have some questions? I have a few of my own. Great. Let's start with the three of you. If it's all right with you, Michael, we'll collect some questions, and then you can respond, and then we'll take a few more. So
and feel free also to answer the questions yourself. I mean,
no, you're not going to shift the burden to the audience.
Oh, yes, I am.
No, it's not going to happen. So please. And please state your name and identify yourself.
Elizabeth Anderson, I'm with the American Society of International Law. And I have two questions. One is, what conclusions can you draw from comparisons between the domestic adjudication of war crimes in Bosnia, Serbia, Croatia, about court design? We've got very different models, different involvement of the international community. And so what do you draw from that? And second, of course, national adjudication, that complementarity has been achievable there only in the last handful of years. And even after the conflict ended and the peace agreement, there wasn't much progress for years at the national level. What hope can we then draw from that experience for the ICC context, where the ICC is investigating and looking at atrocities that have been committed in
conflicts
that are ongoing?
We need a peace agreement, and what are those solutions?
Okay, you got that one.
Well,
you had your
hand. Ian Guest, Georgetown University. A brief comment and a question. First is that your your presentation makes me very unclear about the concept of reconciliation. I mean, you said in passing that you know, Carla Del Ponte had been discouraging because she said that reconciliation is not a job, but I frankly wonder if it is a job. And you know, as a former prosecutor, I personally don't think that prosecutors should be playing a political role. I think they should prosecute the bad guys. So, Neil, maybe you know much more about this than the rest of us, but what does reconciliation mean, and what is the connection between law and reconciliation? Second is a question. You know, the ICC complementarity. The ICC will take up a case if the national government is unable or unwilling. What are we learning about the cases in the Congo, Uganda, and Sudan? What is this telling us? I mean, is there a doctrine that's beginning to emerge? How do we define unable or unwilling based on the cases that are there?
All right, thank you, and then finally.
Susan Notar, American Society of International Law, and I'm struck that you're really raising a lot of big and very important and interesting questions, and I'll look forward to reading both this paper and the book. But I wondered, you mentioned that you're arguing that Bosnia is currently the best model we have for the notion of complementarity with the ICC, and I'm wondering what you think of that in terms of the cases in Africa, of Uganda and Darfur, and whether we can actually have a model in Bosnia that would also, for complementarity, that would also fit with Uganda and Darfur, or whether we need several models depending on the domestic judicial structure.
Great. Well, thank you for your questions. If you
Wonderful questions, obviously. First of all, actually, let me take the last one first, and I'll run back around, if you will. It's my humble opinion that no single model can be replicated anywhere else. You can, however, gain substantial understanding of appropriate lessons to be applied. The first lesson is that we need a clear definition of what an international standard is. With the ICC, there isn't one yet. There isn't a mechanism yet because it's the international community as a whole. We were lucky in Bosnia, and we'll be lucky again in Rwanda, because we have an arbiter of what is international standard, and that's the tribunal that's transferring the cases back to the region in the first instance. Bosnia took on a much larger mandate than just the cases being shipped back from The Hague based on the decision of the national officials. We're not going to make a mini Hague in Sarajevo. And quite frankly, that worked out quite well. But it also allowed them to use the standards of international fair trial and due process arbitrated by the tribunal and its appeals chamber in the 11 bis transfers to set the standard for all of their cases. All right, that's great, except that's an ad hoc tribunal that has no authority over anybody else. So are those international standards appropriate? Suppose we get into cultures that are not French or British. Or their various empires. How do we strike an international, because after all, the ICC is an international court. So I think that's the first hurdle that needs to be addressed, and the world needs to do that aggressively now, in my humble opinion. Secondly, I think the lesson to be learned is that whatever justice model is generated as the complement of the ICC, it must have two things. First of all, a national character, and number two, it has to have a huge and coordinated infusion of determined international support. We cannot say we will invade the sovereignty of a state at the top level and say we have the authority to do this by indicting the leaders, but oh, down here, we have to step back. We can coordinate our efforts here within the ICC, but here, all of a sudden, we don't have that capacity. Even though the development agencies of all the major countries have agreed in the Paris Declaration that we're going to do that. We're going to do it as a basket funding coordinated process. That doesn't happen now. And that was the reason I put the AID thing on the building. It's just sort of comical. Because we don't. We divide up the sector between the various donors, and we start running in different directions. We also are a little bit hesitant about imposing our will unless there's another national agenda. So my strong suggestion, you see it articulated in the paper somewhat, that there is an affirmative obligation on the part of the international community to engage to restore the rule of law on behalf of the people of the country in a context that reflects their values. That's a hugely complex process. Now, some people say that Congo is not a country, and so how would you do it in Congo? As it relates to the ICC, I mean, Luis has undertaken some pretty challenging cases for complementarity. He will find, I suggest, in going to the first second question, that reconciliation will be hard to promote with his indictments. And reconciliation will be hard to promote because it's not certain what the definition of reconciliation is, and sometimes, quite frankly, reconciliation should and does take many centuries, if not many decades, if not centuries. You know, as a prosecutor, I will disagree with you. Madame Del Ponte and I and her predecessors had an obligation to contribute to the peace and reconciliation of the region. That's part of the mandate. Now, if that's the case, there are things that a prosecutor can do to assist the indigenous or national system to become more competent so that the cases that are brought have indeed the consequences or the results that you request. You cannot cut the head off of the beast like this and expect the beast to die. It doesn't. It grows a new head. So if we say we are effectively responding to crimes of this magnitude by cutting off the head and taking the hay, we're deceiving ourselves, and we know that. So as a consequence, when we are saying the prosecutor is relieved from the responsibility of contributing to peace and reconciliation, I completely agree with that if it's interpreted as a political agenda. Absolutely, that's for someone else. But in respect to making certain that there's continuity and consistency in the prosecutorial mandate and coherence in the prosecutorial mandate, that is clearly our obligation. Let me give you an example. There has never been, and this is not Del Ponte's fault alone, it's also Richard Goldstone's and Luis Arbor's, there has never been an articulation of what the scope of the authority of the ICTY prosecutor, her strategy or his strategy, should or will be. It is, if you look at the indictments and spread them out over a chart like that, you will be confused. Because if indeed this particular person, Dragon Nikolic, one of the first indictments of the tribunal, a camp guard in Lasanitsa, in Sushitsa camp, he was there for the three-month life of the camp. It was a warehouse where they dumped people that they were cleansing from the Lasanitsa municipality. He was a drunk, and people got hurt, killed, raped, and he participated. He was indicted, brought to the Hague. How many other Dragon Nikolic's were there? How many others should have been brought to the Hague? How many on this line? Was he representative of a class, or was he the entire class? And you have to answer those questions if you are indeed the single arbiter of that process. The prosecutor in the court of Bosnia-Herzegovina learned that lesson and sat down for 6 months before he brought a single indictment and used all of the international resources and all of his own resources to review every one of the rules of the road cases. Rules of the road cases, for those of you who don't know, and this goes to your question. In 1995, after Dayton, there was a confusion about who you negotiated with, because the negotiating partners were certainly suspect. I think a man by the name of Slobodan Milosevic was one of them. And in the confusing borders within Bosnia-Herzegovina, between Srpska and the Federation, there were roads that crossed over several times the boundaries. And sure enough, in the middle of a negotiation with one particular leader, he got arrested by the other side because his car went the wrong way on a particular road that was unmarked. So the Americans and others said we must have a rules of the road. We must have rules of the road so that we know that these people can pass in the negotiation process with immunity. So they don't get arrested. We
have problems with our diplomatic negotiations. It was also one of them who was shipped to The Hague, ultimately, and that was what caused it. In the agreement, all indictments coming out of Bosnia had to be approved and cleared by the prosecutor in The Hague. And in 1997, I was asked by the State Department, along with two other American prosecutors, to go 2 years after it had started, collect all the files that had been accumulating in the prosecutor's office because they didn't have the resources to do it, and set up a review process. I was also fortunate enough in 2005 to end the rules of the road review process by subsuming it within the mandate of the state court prosecutor, Marinko Jurcevic, in Bosnia. He took all those cases and said, all right, we're going to build the universe of cases, investigations that exist at the present, and we're going to explain where in this hierarchy our authority will lie. He did that because we made it. We said, we're going to build a court around your mandate, and we're going to build that court around your expectations and your ambitions. Tell us what they are. And he said, well, the cases that they send to me. Not good enough. So he did the review, set up the set of criteria, defined the universe on a level of severity that fit the resources we were putting. $8 million a year is a lot of money in Bosnia for one court. Even though it's a small fraction of what the tribunal gets, it's still a lot of money. And there are canton and district courts that ought to be given resources as well. So how do you differentiate? If you want to sustain the justice model in perpetuity. Remember, Rudolf Haas was was a witness at Auschwitz, the commandant of Auschwitz. He was a witness at Nuremberg. After he testified, they shipped him back to Poland. He was prosecuted by a then national court and executed in 48, I guess it was. It wasn't until 1960 that the rest of his command staff from Auschwitz-Birkenau were prosecuted in the Frankfurt High Court, a national court. This is a long-term investment, and an ad hoc legal institution is kind of a funny oxymoron. So the durability of our commitment has to be reflected in our consumption of the resources, which has to be reflected in a rational hierarchy of the workload. Your question. It is my humble opinion, and this is why Lynn earlier said that USIP disclaims anything I say. It is my opinion that the international community interpreted war crimes prosecution as being anti-Dayton in Bosnia during most of the last 10 years, and that the encouragement in terms of resources and other political pressures resulted in very few prosecutions occurring. I don't believe that that was as a result of an indigenous capacity. You use the term achievable, that there was, that local prosecutions was not achievable in Bosnia. The implication is that it's not achievable because Bosnians were not able to do it, for whatever reason, politics, resources, whatever. I would take issue with that, and I think that's one of the things that we need to aggressively review, because I don't know whether I'm right or not. We need to look at Bosnia and see how the international community's participation in assisting to reconstruct a society impacts its own willingness or impetus or capacity to achieve a reconciliation through traditional rule of law institutions. Because I don't think, certainly in Rwanda, if you look at Rwanda today, the international community has put an awful lot of money into Arusha. It's put some money into Rwanda, and it's done some work. I know Neil has been a large advocate for that for a long time. But the capacity in Rwanda is in terms of resources, has been traditionally a very small percentage of what we've given the national system. And they've had a massively greater and more immediate challenge. So I would argue that we need to do the research to find out whether or not they didn't want to do it or we didn't want them to do it that caused them not doing it. Is that a good answer?
Okay. All right, let's have a few more questions. Let's start on this side of the room.
You've got two.
I favored this side of the room before, so let's favor this side of the room now.
Right. Tom Black, member of the D.C. Bar. A number of times in your talk, you adverted to international standards of justice and used the ICTY as an illustration of those standards and the blessings of ICTY as definitive that other courts can be achieve international standards. Are the standards of due process applied in the ICTY the same as international standards of due process? And maybe if you answer that question, you could make reference to the Sadich case, where condemnation by anonymous witnesses were deemed to be the norm, the very sort of evil that we're trying to fight in places like Guantanamo now. Does the ICTY, and indeed can the ICC, achieve an international standard of due process?
Okay, can we collect a couple more questions? There were Carla and then Andrew.
Hi, I'm Carla Winston. I work here as one of my colleagues, actually. You mentioned the impression that a lot of people thought that prosecutions were anti-Dayton. Do you think that in terms of overall strategies for long-term reconciliation, there's a lower line to be drawn on the triangle somewhere for just even though a crime was committed, the relative utility of pursuing judicial responses just isn't there, that instead of prosecuting somebody for shooting the incendiary or bombing the library, we should just go to the library?
Okay. Thank you. And finally, Andrew.
I'll try to do two quick questions. Mm-hmm. You highlighted the role of the international community in the establishment of the, or supporting the establishment of the state court in Bosnia, and also a little bit about the role of that institution. Do you have any insight you can provide into the establishment of a similar body in Serbia, the war crimes panel there, which I think is still affiliated with the Belgrade District Court?
Yep.
Okay. And then some of the challenges of in that context. And then secondly, any comments on the recent decision of the International Court of Justice and that institution's role, and it is a civil institution, in its grounding state responsibility for certain international crimes?
Again, I'll do in reverse.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, I was appalled by the decision of the ICJ. That's all I need to say, I hope. I think that the process was flawed, perhaps, maybe not. It just appears to me that the evidence is overwhelming. On the other hand, there's argument that they didn't see all the evidence. So I think the decision was appalling to me, and I'm very, very unfortunate. In respect to the local courts in both Zagreb and Belgrade, I think that the Belgrade War Crimes Initiative has been very successful. It is different than Bosnia in that it's not an international hybrid of any kind. There's no international support other than sort of encouragement. And I know that Patrick Lopez-Terez, the chief of investigations for the ICTY, has worked very closely with that court for a number of years. And the Vukovar cases were sent there, the lower levels, and they also, as I said, indicted the shooters from the Scorpion tape. However, that court also, according to the New York Times, indicated that there was no evidence whatsoever that these paramilitaries who were being prosecuted in Serbia had been constituted in Serbia of Serbian officials or citizens and sent to Bosnia to engage with the Bosnian Serb army had any affiliation with Serbia. It was sort of shocks the conscience. So I would say that in some respects they've done very well, and I know there's a lot of evidence sharing between the Office of the Prosecutor in The Hague and the court in Belgrade. I think that's very positive. They're probably the tip of the spear out front of some of the other positions the government is taking. That's good. I know also that the chief prosecutor, Marinko Jurcevic, is working with both Belgrade and Zagreb to try to build some mechanism for regional treatment of these cases and enabling them to overcome the constitutional impediment to extradition. Because essentially it's contrary to the Constitution, the Serbian Constitution, to
to ship a citizen out for trial. That's also a little bit strange when the citizenship was granted a few weeks after or before the indictment, but there's still that kind of game. Carla, explain the question a little more in detail.
Well, I'm thinking in terms of judicial versus non-judicial mechanisms for reconciliation of the no-jail impression of the Gachacha system and what it's good for. Is there a point at which you say, yes, I know you committed a crime, and yes, it was a bad crime, but our money is better spent doing something other than prosecuting?
Yes. And to answer, Professor, your question from another perspective, as a state prosecutor, I convinced our budgetary authority to divert resources from my office to diversion and restorative justice models because, in our estimation, they were far more efficient in addressing the level of culpability that the particular class of individuals or class of crimes presented. So I think non-judicial or non-retributive judicial options are absolutely necessary. However, the Truth Commission process has to be integrated into the trial and indictment process. That's the way it was done, certainly in its own construct in South Africa. But they need to be an integrated justice response. They can't be fragmented. Because again, it's justice in whose eyes? It satisfies us from a distance because our objective is to regain some level of stability and back off our commitment of soldiers. But how long will that last, and what kind of life do these people have? What kind of opportunity do they have to rebuild their culture and their structure? I think the answer is yes, absolutely. But how, and the allocation of resources can be done much more effectively at the national level when you are dividing them between retributive and non-retributive options as a broader strategy. But the Luis Ocampos and the Carla Del Pontes need to be involved in that because they are nonetheless a catalyst for that process, whether it's one or the other. In respect to international standards, let me say what you were polite enough not to say. And let me say it in a sort of odd way. I was with the American Bar Association for a long time, and we struggled to develop and maintain the national criminal justice standards, which define fair trial and due process in our country as aspirational standards of conduct and structures. They're in the third edition. I was the chairman of that committee for a period of time. They were started by Warren Berger back in 1969. That process included defense counsel, judges, prosecutors, academics, and the rest. I recall one Florida defense attorney who was absolutely a wonderful and sincere and committed lawyer and the rest, who said, my reason for participating in the standards process is because I am convinced that you cannot get a fair trial in the federal system of the United States of America. Okay, we're all entitled to our opinions. That said, there are people and good colleagues of mine who have been defense counsel in the tribunals who have the same opinion of the ad hoc tribunals in both Rwanda and Yugoslavia. There are huge flaws in the manner in which that jurisprudence has evolved. And I have great issue. Very recently, you might want to read it, Judge Antonetti got a earful from Ken Scott, an American prosecutor, in a case on just that issue. The prosecutor believing that the case was not going to be fair and told him so on the record rather boldly and courageously. And Ken's a former federal prosecutor in Denver, great guy. And Judge Antonetti's a French judge, and he took issue with him, obviously. It is my humble opinion that the tribunal's jurisprudence is instructive, and it's certainly helpful, but I don't think their procedure will be replicated, and it is not an international standard for absolute transfer in any other tribunal. It is, however, extremely important in respect to the transfer of cases from the tribunal indictment list back to the region, to the courts that are conducting trials under 11 bis there. And that's what we were challenged with when we built the court, or the War Crimes Chamber, in Sarajevo. That's why I said earlier, the international standards are a huge undertaking. We were lucky in Bosnia because we had an arbiter of those standards for our purposes alone. But I'll tell you that the Bosnians don't like it. They certainly don't like the common law criminal procedural code that we imposed on them a couple of years before I got there. That reflects very much of an American-British model, and they're not either. Their judges are still grappling with some of the aspects of that process. The world has huge challenges in meeting the objective of building a coherent international justice system that integrates well with sovereign states. We're just at the very beginning of that. I'm not sure any of us will be alive when that comes to a point where we can say comfortably that that works. But I know 200 years after our own justice system was started in this country, there are many people who still have the opinion, as that lawyer does in Florida, that our system doesn't work. And it was John Marshall that took, what, 30-something years before he ever got judicial review by the Supreme Court really confirmed. And then we had to have a civil war to decide whether or not that was true. We're at an exciting time. And when you talk to young lawyers who have an interest in this, this is a very exciting time. But we need to focus on those hard issues. And we need to avoid assuming or taking for granted that certain things are absolutes. I agree with you. And those tribunals are not absolutes.
Okay, thank you. Let's move on to this lady in the center back, then to you and Michael.
Mm-hmm.
Please say your name and your affiliation.
In London, we are London-based. It does a lot of the law work in the Balkans. First, linked to I think what you were mentioning about tribunal and procedural standards. I think that's a fair point, the one you made, but it is rather damaging, we find, on the field when you are doing, say, rule of law training, because this is going to be flagged first by domestic judges and domestic lawyers, because tribunals should be the institution of excellence, and one of the purposes should be help rebuild system of rule of law, build it really, because in many parts of former Yugoslavia it didn't properly exist. So I think there is a problem.
That comment I happen to agree with, but it flies in the face of the question of whether or not that's their obligation. What is the role of justice?
Second thing is that I originally come from Serbia, and I'm unfortunately a bit more less optimistic about what domestic institutions in Serbia can do. I just so happened to be doing some work now a couple of weeks ago when Scorpio judgment was passed, which I think actually is not a very good judgment. I mean, judges couldn't do anything but find in face of this overwhelming evidence these people guilty. But as you rightly point out, they then bend over backwards to portray them as complete freelancers who have nothing to do with state institutions. Then you have some of the people, most notably Dan Satievic, who is a journalist for Time and Bremen, go actually on TV and say this, that judgment is flawed in many ways. And then a couple of days later, there is a bomb in front of his window, his flat, in the middle of the night, and it was apparently by assessment of police, serious attempt rather than just a warning, because they sleep in this bedroom. They just so happen not to be there. Ordinary police is trying to apparently do what they can, except that they can't do much. State security, meanwhile, goes on record saying, well, you know, we'd love to help. And before internationals got involved, etc., we had links with organized crime and we'd be able to find who it is. But now we are whiter than a white. We can't do anything. It's basically, their message is, we may have not organized it, but we're certainly glad. And, you know, meanwhile, judges are receiving threats, et cetera, et cetera. Judge Bogukovar went on record saying that, judging Scorpio case. So I'm just not sure that there is political will and that the society as a whole is ready for these sort of cases.
You know that there is a great deal of pressure in regard to Partnership for Peace in terms of making reasonable progress in those areas, and that the United States government has and its allies has
granted partnership for peace to Serbia in spite of those limited achievements. What do you think that says to Serbia?
I don't know. I think when you look at the polling in Serbia recently, that's why I actually find the poll situation rather depressing, is that actually nationalist sentiments are still pretty strong. And I suppose also within the European Union framework, the question is, do you kind of try and get them in on track and then slowly steer them in the right direction? Because I suppose that was the whole issue with the partnership piece. Do you make it such a remote possibility that actually they stop believing it's ever going to happen, or do you kind of get them in, but then they continue doing their own thing anyway? And I just think that Serbia, before things get better, will stagnate, or things possibly will go worse. And then in package with that, I can't see that you'll see a lot of success with domestic files and all that crap.
See, I think that highlights the question that I had. If indeed there is an affirmative obligation of the international community to engage with a country to restore the rule of law to a whatever it is international standard on the domestic side, after it has engaged on the leadership side, those most responsible, how does it do it? That mechanism can be, does it militarily invade the country as it did in Bosnia? Or does it attempt the carrot and stick approach as it does in Serbia? Or in Congo, what does it do at all? The method is always the details that make one mad.
Let's move on. We've got about 7 minutes left, so please.
My name is Mary Muller, and I work with the Bosnia Support Committee, but I wanted to talk mainly about Africa at the present moment. There were women here from Liberia this week, and they were stating that they were part of the peace process. You know, they were speaking with the rebels and then with the government and so forth, and they said that they didn't like the idea of Western people imposing upon them Western justice, and that they would not testify against Charles Taylor or the generals. In fact, the generals involved, they had integrated them into society, which to me, I felt, if they ever ran for office what kind of country would it be, is what I was thinking. And also, Louise Arbour, I saw a film that was showing how she had tremendous problem with the the generals, speaking of generals again, the British, the American, and the French generals in the Balkans that wouldn't let her go forward and try these people. And I just wanted to make another, this young lady over here was talking about, do you spend money on court proceeding, or do you, like in South Africa, I always felt, is there some type of social justice that you can impose upon these people, for instance, if you don't put them into court, force them to be part of the rehabilitation process or the rebuilding, taking it out of their salary, or actually making them take part in rebuilding a hospital in some way, or rebuilding a school or something like that. Just stay in Africa, or for instance, in South Africa, there are 100 quarter toilets in Sarajevo for thousands of people still today. And I'm wondering in the reconciliation and the truth commission, if people have testified that they have suppressed these people for so many years, then why couldn't they be forced in some way to rebuild, to go into Soweto where they probably have never been, and to rebuild some of the things that they need, like more toilets.
Okay, thank you. Can we just get Michael's question and give you a few minutes to answer before we close it too?
Michael Dobbs with the U.S. Institute of Peace. I just wondered if you could clarify a couple of things. You seem to suggest that the ICC or the ICTY had no business prosecuting people like Dragan Nikolic.
Not exactly, but... Yeah.
I mean, if so, I mean, is that your position that they should have only they should have cut it off at the very senior levels, or you know, how many people like Dragan Nikolic should they have prosecuted? And just as a matter of information, you know, how many of their prosecutions were of those lower level people, and how much have the national courts in Bosnia, how successful have they been at prosecuting this that universe of people you've put below your line? Can you give us some figures then?
Yeah, it's been very successful. And actually, I called over last night and asked Toby Cadman, who's the head of the international prosecution side of it under the registrar, for some figures. And I didn't bring them down, but I'll give them to you later. They have been very successful. In fact, Stankovic, the first person who was transferred, has already been tried and convicted and sentenced. There are, I think, a number of hurdles that they have to overcome and a lot of issues that have to be fixed, problems that people did not anticipate. And the largest of which is the process of removing the internationals from the mechanisms of the court. We had just started reducing the number of international judges in the organized crime side a year ago. A year ago, I was sitting in the in Brussels at the donors conference, the last donors conference that we had. I think they've done very well, and I think they've done extremely well in the view of Human Rights Watch and in the OSCE's reviews. They've been critical of the process, but the and also Soros, the Justice Initiative people, have done very extensive reviews of the court and said, Neil, you're probably more objective on that than I am, but you know, there's this problem, that problem, the other problem, you should refinements and corrections, but the most part doing an exceptionally good job of trying to figure out international, acceptable national standards. And it's tough. I think to clarify my position, it is inappropriate, and this is not defensive on my part, since I've been involved with the court since 97 in one way or another. It's not defensive to say that you can't criticize the ICTY for making mistakes. It is, in my humble opinion, the greatest achievement in the rule of law in the history of man, or humankind, because it did shift that paradigm dramatically between local or dispersed justice and the ability to enforce a set of common values universally. Again, it had a lot of shortcomings, Rwanda in it as well, and hopefully will quickly produce even more impressive achievements in that one. But it was a very substantial alteration in our world. However, I will fault the tribunal for not learning from its mistakes and implementing those lessons learned in a timely fashion. And one of those was correcting its indictment strategy. It didn't have one. And I know that very well. It still doesn't have one. The completion strategy is as close as the tribunal got to a prosecution strategy. If you want to use resources efficiently, you have to define your mission. And they never did, other than those most responsible. Now, understanding why they got where they got, I'll be happy to spend a couple hours doing that. But the bottom line is, we didn't know what actually the dynamics, the sophisticated dynamics of political power in the Balkans were in an evidentiary way. And that's, I think, that Canadian movie about Louise Arbour, which is entertaining. We didn't know what the dynamics were. Who did what when and how? That evidence, and I mentioned that briefly in my paper, that evidence comes from intelligence services. Who's talking to those major leaders? Contemporaneous with their criminal behavior? We are. Our leaders, our diplomatic corps, our intelligence services intercepting their communications. And that's Rule 70 evidence. And that only comes to the tribunal and the prosecutors when they let it come and when they tell us that they have it. And I'll tell you, that whole issue of Rule 50 and Rule 70, which are the procedures that allow evidence to be exchanged in that fashion, is very difficult. The Kosovo, the war in Kosovo, the major supporters of that institution are the United States, NATO, certainly, and the UK. Well, what was Serbia saying about the airstrikes? Is that something that is within the jurisdiction of the prosecutor? Where does that evidence come, etc.? That's all a part of balancing sovereignty and the independence of the judiciary. Independence of a judicial institution is absolutely fundamental. And acquiring that independence and sustaining that independence is a hugely difficult a process, especially when the governments are the ones that are the benefactors of that. I mean, anybody who's been a prosecutor knows that you get those calls. This is the Gonzales issue. You get calls from politicians about cases they're interested in, and you tell them thank you very much for their input and hang up on them. You can't do that when the dynamics are a little more dramatic. You can't do that quite so clearly. Alternatives, yes, lots of them, but those should be decided in our frustration with how complex it is, Gachacha and the rest, should not be our prerogative to say to them, get over it. They should be given the resources. I'll tell you today, the United States government spends millions, if not billions of dollars, seeking to find ways to mitigate the consequences of our justice system that incarcerates more people than most countries do. And we have a non-trial disposition process called plea bargaining for 90-something percent of them. There are some people outside of the United States who don't consider that an international standard either. The debate is not one that will be solved by diplomats quickly and comfortably. It's a process that is ongoing and dynamic. It's called self-governance. Self-governance of justice institutions requires help in these circles.
Okay, thank you. We're a little bit past two. I think we have to quit now. Michael will be available afterwards for further questions.
And I've got my travel log here.
Right. I'd like to thank him again for a great presentation, and thank you all for coming.